It is Saturday, September 14th, 2013. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio, 889 and KOSP.org. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. I'm Lyle Trox. With me in the studio today is Brian Young. He's an iOS developer.
Hey there, Lyle.
How's it going? And we also have Lindsay, and Lindsay is a systems analyst, support engineer, and software engineer.
Good morning.
Great. Thank you. Brian, did I introduce you?
Yes, you did.
Oh, good. But did I tell people who you what you do?
What do I do?
You are an iOS developer and a designer. You're a virtual lighting designer, and you're currently looking for work.
Yes, I am.
I've said to you a couple times since you've come on the show. So if anyone's interested in what Brian has to say or interested in hiring a kind of amazing developer and a great guy, please do get in touch with the show. And you can ask us questions and get in touch with any of us at geeks@geekspeak.org. Lindsay, tell us what's going on with old tech.
Sure. Oh, Windows XP. How do I love thee? I'm sitting here staring at my laptop, and it's an XP laptop. I had to custom order when they had, you know, other Vista versions and things like that available.
You bought it post XP.
Exactly. And on April 8th of 2014, Microsoft is retiring XP. It's called end of life in geek terms. And what that means is that they won't be releasing any more security updates to the average user, so that any security flaws that hackers find will no longer be fixed.
Mm-hmm.
So they've done the same things with 95, 98, ME, and Vista's end of life will be April 11, 2017. Windows 7 is January 14, 2020. They actually extended XP's end of life date several times because people were clamoring for that. And it first appeared in 2001, and as late as 2010, computers were still sold with XP installed.
Wow.
Whereas Vista arrived 6 years after XP and only lasted until 2011. So XP is going to be nearly 13 years old when they retire it. So as far as Microsoft operating systems go, it's pretty great.
And I hear a lot of love for XP. I mean, there's definitely that desire. And it's, I think it's specifically because it seems like Microsoft does this toggle thing where they do a great operating system, then do a bad one, then do a great one, then do a bad one. And so you're on XP, and everyone's getting Vista, and you're getting excited, and you try it, and it's get all this bad reviews, and be like, I'll just stay where I am. And then that kind of stays through for a while. Windows 8 is actually pretty good, right? Mm-hmm. Or Windows 7, I'm sorry. Windows 7's good? I can never keep track. So it's Vista, then 7.
Right.
Yeah. So 7 supposedly is really good. 8's got that whole bad interface, which they got rid of to some degree on the patch.
Right.
But are you happy that you're going to have to move, or are you kind of bummed? And what about Ubuntu instead?
Right. Let's go Linux. I would definitely think about that. I don't know what my work is going to have me do, because they'll probably issue me a laptop, and now you can't really get them without Windows 8 on them.
Yeah.
It's hard. You can custom order them with 7 on them. But you can't do a direct upgrade from XP to 7. You would have to, you know, wipe everything and salt clean, and no average user is going to probably bother to do that.
I got to say, though, that especially with this thing, you really just can't be running XP after the 4th of April something, because the vulnerabilities we're talking about are severe. You know, you have to be patching a Microsoft system, or any computer system has to be patched all the time. And if they're not going to make patches, unless some external firm takes it over, but I don't think it will. I think that we're going to see
goodbye. I have my doubts about that. And, you know, like Brian was saying earlier, you know, you don't want to have a bunch of zombie computers out there, you know, flooding everybody else.
We already do.
Right, yeah. We don't need more. We don't need more of them. But there's a lot of security features that were introduced just in Vista that are not incorporated with XP. So even my computer is a little less secure than some people that have more modern systems. And also for web developers like me and other people that I know, and, you know, hi, Brian. Yeah. They really are glad this is happening because of the fact that there's custom browser versions for IE just so that people can still run XP, and they have to develop just for those.
No, I'm happy to see those goodbye. Bye.
Yeah, sure. Exactly. And if you have old peripherals, printers, and things like that, some people are going to have to get new peripherals for their new versions. You'll have to check if they're compatible. And, you know, like I said, you can't do an in-place upgrade. But the drastic UI change is going to be interesting for some people. But that seems to be the way of the future is
once
the
you
mobile
migrate,
style.
Yeah. Once you migrate to a new OS, and I'd love to hear your take on, like, having it as a primary machine, you know, a couple months when you actually move it over, whatever it happens.
Yeah.
Because I definitely stuck to XP for quite a while. I think my home Windows machine's Vista, but I haven't turned it on for 2 months. Right. So it doesn't matter to me that it happens to be that operating system. But XP, definitely here at the station, we still have XP machines for editing.
Yeah. I like the overall idea that we're going more mobile and universal platform across mobile and PC.
Yeah.
And that'll probably evolve pretty quickly.
So, Brian, thank you very much, Lindsay. Great story. Brian, tell us what's going on in the hacking space and NSA and all that stuff. Keep us abreast of that.
So, yeah, we've talked about NSA and Prism and all of the Snowden information for quite a while now. But I wanted to bring something else up to everybody's attention that people may not be thinking about as much. Here, let me introduce you to this.
Remote Control System Da Vinci. The hacking suite for governmental interception.
Ew.
Does that have a scary overtone or what?
That's horrible.
So, of course, there's a market out there for government and police to get tools in order to get the bad guys. And I want to say right up front, I'm all for getting the bad guys. But in the process of that, we always, as a community, as a public, we need to be aware of the way things can be going wrong. So what this is a group called Hacking Team has created a...
creative name.
Yes, exactly. A all-inclusive package for man-in-the-middle attacks and gaining access to encrypted information. Now, like we talked last week, the math behind encryption is totally solid. But what they're doing is getting in the middle of these communications and spoofing things such that you might see a little error on your web browser that the certificate's not right. And most people just click through that and say, it's fine. It's fine. I've seen enough of these errors.
Mm-hmm.
But through this kind of software, they can get into encrypted Skype conversations. They can get into most of the encrypted conversations that we have if we're not actually thinking and diligent. So
encrypted, too.
Yes.
Only because they redirect you away from the encrypted path.
So what they're doing is they're setting themselves up as the people on the other end without you noticing if you're not vigilant. Well, the important part of this is for police departments around the country, around the world. They have not yet had a large presence in the United States, but with larger police departments out there like L.A., New York, they've definitely been trying to get into this market. And I just want the public to think about what their elected officials should be doing to safeguard us as a public and as not the bad guys.
Yeah. I mean, does it mean that if there's a market like this, can a police officer working on a case just go and get the software and start using it to collect data? Where's the rule set for this kind of
stuff? So the precedents in America are a little bit fuzzy on this, but it's assumed that they would have to go through the wiretapping mechanism with a judge to get a sign off. But
that might not be that hard to get.
It may not be, and for catching some bad guys is
the thing that's
entirely
creepy.
Appropriate.
The thing that's creepy is from a technical perspective of this, let's say a judge goes, that person, clearly, I see the case laid out in front of me, I definitely want you to be able to hack into the machine, tap them and all that. The judge is saying, I want the police officer to be able to do this, to collect information, right, or the DA, whatever it's going to be, right? So you've got some official, this should happen because it's important and we agree upon it, which is what the court system's for, right? It's why we have the protection for the judicial system to review what the executive branch police force is doing, right? So that makes sense. But the problem here is that the software that's being used is putting a backdoor in the system that other people can then take advantage of. And the judge is not going to be aware of that, right? So let's say there's a case enough to investigate Brian because he's selling chickens on the black market or something. And so they get a court order to tap your line and get the software installed in your machine. And then, you know, Lindsay comes along who likes to steal credit cards and goes, hey, this system's open. I can go ahead and step in there with the police and get all of Brian's information. And by the way, it wasn't illegal what Brian was doing. They don't pursue the case, but Lindsay still got his credit card, right? And that's not what the judge is suggesting. But because this technology is designed that way to insert a backdoor into the system, there's no way to protect the person that gets targeted. That's the problem for me. That's the major problem.
And elected officials and judges just don't
have
the technical understanding to even grasp that.
That's right. So if you're an elected official and you want to know a little more about this, please hit me up on email or something, and I'll fill you in what I can. I'll hook you up to people that know a lot more than I do. If you're a police officer or work in the police force and this kind of stuff is going on, you really need to think about the side effects that you're doing to the people that are being targeted. I know that they're the target, but you got to keep in mind that you might be doing something that's akin to unlocking their door and opening it and walking away. And you wouldn't do that as a police officer. So think about the software you're using. Okay. Shall we move on, Brian? Or do you have more of that story?
What's your email?
Oh, just go to geeks at geekspeak.org. Go to geekspeak.org and you can click on a contact link. So geekspeak.org has all the stuff about today's show and all that as well. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Lindsay Lonnie and Brian Young. And I want to talk about real journalism for a minute.
Lyle, do you consider yourself a journalist?
No. I don't consider myself a journalist because most of what we do is read other stories and give opinion about it, right? So there's definitely, I have rarely broken news, right? At the same time, if I did get a story about something that no one else knew about and I broke that news, I would love to be able to hide my source, right? That ruling to say when you can and cannot hide your source is a really interesting one. I think that because of the classical form of this show, that it's broadcast on the radio, I would probably have a higher percentage chance of passing the system in allowing protection because I happen to have the radio. But I could do the exact same show through just podcasts. In fact, I think we might have more listeners through the podcast than through on air. And then it becomes really questionable. So there's actually a bill in Congress right now. It's actually passed some of the legislative sides and is going to be going to a vote. It's called the Free Flow of Information Act of 2013. They've been working on it since 2009, but they had a bit of a hiatus when WikiLeaks hit the mainstream, right? So because that's gotten delayed, Senator Charles Schumer has said, the world has changed, quoting him, the world has changed. We're very careful in the bill to distinguish journalists from those who shouldn't be protected. WikiLeaks and all those, and we're ensured that. And he continues, but there are people who write and do real journalism in different ways than we used to do, and they should not be excluded from this bill. So the idea of the bill, of course, and that's Senator Schumer, the idea of the bill, of course, is that you legislatively say when you are representing a story, you can hide your source. It's that whole free news journalism thing that's gone existing for a long time. They're clarifying some things. Now, Schumer has been fighting Feinstein. Dianne Feinstein is the senator for California. And she's saying that only real reporters should have protection. So the question is really about the real reporter situation, right?
Well, what's fascinating about this is we're at a time where news and newspapers and television is drastically changing, and they're having a harder and harder time funding their news outfits, and they're relying more and more on sources and citizen reporters who draw no salary. And I think that's one of the big distinctions they draw here.
One of the distinctions is whether you get paid or not. The current bill does protect bloggers, and the way it decides whether you are protected or not is it permits a judge to decide. Right, so it becomes that still it's a really tricky situation. When do you decide you're a professional or not? If you're getting paid enough, if your only income source is that, then you get this protection. That seems ridiculous. It seems like so. The other thing about this, the sideline of this, is if you are not doing something professionally, it's not your source of income, and you have a news story that you want to be protected. It's easier now to. I mean, you can do anonymous, right? You can do that kind of thing. So the question is. And then just give it to a journalist that does have the protection. So to some degree, clarification would be nice. I think it's kind of creepy to say, if you're a journalist, and that's the line, and then the judge decides, because then you don't know if you're safe or not. And I don't like that very much. So, Lindsay, do you have something to that? I'm sorry, did you want to say something about that?
No, I'm just, the fact that the judge is the one making the decision is what's getting to me. I'm wondering who would make the decision on what defines a journalist and what doesn't. Like, who's the right person to make those decisions? Because you've got two sides of it. You've got the people who say they're journalists and the journalist side, and then you've got the legal judicial side, but there should be some independent in between that's not interested, less interested party or whatever.
Yeah, but then again, if you have a judgment like that, it's like the pornography thing, right? We'll know when we see it kind of, and how do you decide what it is? All of us relay stories that we've heard. That's a human tradition, right? You hear something and then you relay it. I mean, half the conversations that Brian and I talk about technology throughout the week is we start describing something to somebody else and they say, oh, yeah, I heard that too, right? So we stop each other from describing. But inherently, we do that. We tell stories. Mm-hmm. And to say that, some people have the right to tell stories in a certain way and some people don't just because they happen to have a job that is endorsed by some company or something. It seems ridiculous. It seems like it should be an inalienable human right in general.
Well, it's a distinction that seemed obvious in an age where that's the way news got disseminated. But now that everybody's a publisher and everybody can spread the word, it's just not clear.
Yeah. Interesting. Currently, Paul Boyle, he's the senior vice president at the Newspaper Association of America, says that this law would have, if it was an act, would have protected two AP journalists from federal investigations. They were doing an investigation on terrorists and they got investigated themselves. So this law would be, it's an improvement. And that law is the Free Flow of Information Act of 2013. which looks like it's going to protect bloggers, but judges have to decide what a blogger is.
Right.
All right. Shall we move on? You want to tell us a bit about space, Lindsay?
I would.
You know what? Before we do that...
Stay in touch with the best of KUSP. Visit our Facebook page or follow us at Twitter.
You're listening to GeekSpeak. You can follow and pay attention to GeekSpeak as well on Twitter and Facebook and all that stuff. And the show notes after the show are up at geekspeak.org. Can you turn an ordinary man into a mass killer? Human rights scholar James Dwines says yes. It's all too easy to break and remake a personality. Dwines talks to KUSP's Robert Pauly about his encounters with the Japanese war criminals known as Chikurin. They were trained to commit atrocities against the Chinese during World War II. Then, captured by the Chinese after the war, they were retrained as peace activists. Our all-too-malleable human nature on the next 7th Avenue Project here on KUSP. That's tomorrow on KUSP. And, of course, you can also listen to the podcast from KUSP.org, provided through by NPR, I believe. You're listening to GeekSpeak on KUSP. I'm Lyle Troxell. With me in the air room is Lindsay Lonnie and Brian Young. You can call us in another 20 minutes. You can make a phone call if you'd like to ask us questions. The number is 800-655-5877. I'll give out that number again when I invite your participation. Space.
The final frontier. You always have to follow it up with that.
That's true. So
NASA has confirmed that after 36 years of journeying, Voyager 1 has reached interstellar space. So Voyager 1 has been traveling for about a year through a transitional plasma region in the space between the influence of the star's sun and other stars. And they got some signals back and were able to confirm that it passed through that and is now in stellar space. Stellar. It was launched in 77, and about 2 weeks after Voyager 2, they were designed to gather information about the outer solar system. On board Voyager 1 is a gold record. Do you remember the stuff?
Yes.
Has a gold record.
This is a controversial thing at the time.
Right. Has a bunch of Earth sounds, including the music of Mozart and also Carl Sagan's son. Yeah. Since its launch, it's traveled an estimated 12 billion miles away from the sun. Yeah. During that journey, we've gotten all kinds of great stuff back, including the discovery of volcanic activity on Jupiter's moon that we wouldn't have known about otherwise, and that famous pale blue dot image of Earth.
Yeah, that's right.
I'll put up a link to that. Yeah. It turned around and took that shot right before it left. I think that's great. But yeah, it's predicted that the nuclear-powered part of the satellite will lose power in about 10 years. So we'll have about another 10 years.
It'll keep going. But we just won't hear anything from it anymore.
Right. And they're saying that it's the first stellar explorer from Earth.
Yeah.
But there is other stuff that might be out there we just don't have contact with any longer.
On GeekSpeak, we talk about this every 3 years or so because it gets a little further away, And there's all this discussion of, has it left the solar system? Has it left the solar system? Of course, gravitationally, our sun is attracted to the center of the galaxy, right? So there's no definition line.
Well,
there is this this point at which the solar wind stops. That's kind of what it's past now, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, it's completely an interstellar media.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. Thank you for the interstellar update.
No problem.
Brian, we can't go on GeekSpeak and not talk about the new iPhone. That happened this week. Specifically, I'd love to get your take on the fingerprinting stuff and find out how this works and all that. Do you mind?
Yeah, so this has been rumored for a while, but now we can actually talk about it with confidence that Apple is doing it. So last week we talked about the difference between authentication and
authorization.
Mm-hmm. So this is a huge thing in trying to identify that you are you and that you can therefore see this web page or see this information or do this, whatever this thing is. So we've had fingerprint sensors on computers and around in available to people for a good 10 years or more. I think.
Yeah, Lindsay, do you have one on your ThinkPad?
Yeah, it's got a thumb.
Do you ever use it?
I used it for the first couple months, and then I stopped using it.
Now, that one's like a little bar, and you just swipe your finger across it, scans your finger, and then and compares it to an image, and you can actually do full disk encryption with that image.
Yep.
Go on, Brian.
So, supposedly, the technology for the iPhone, they've gotten it to the point where they really believe in it, and Apple usually doesn't put hardware out there that they don't think will be very close to 100% effective. So, it's pretty exciting in the sense that most people probably don't lock their phones, and most people do not create nice, good, long, random passwords because it is just plain inconvenient. If this works on the iPhone, it's the first sort of mass market unit where people will be able to just use their finger or their thumb or any of five fingers, including your wife or your partner's finger, mm-hmm. to unlock your phone. And what this does is, along with another technology that Apple's trying to push, which will not be out immediately with iOS 7, but will come out soon, it's called iCloud Keychain. And that will allow you to actually create random long passwords that you do not have to in any way remember if it hooks into the system well enough. So you'll put your finger on your phone and it'll unlock your phone, but it'll also be initially used for buying things on iTunes or what else do you buy through Apple?
You can buy stuff from their app store and buy new devices.
The app store.
So they're going to trust this as the only authentication method.
Well, not the only one. You can still use passwords. Nothing will change.
But
if
I mean,
you don't
they will support it potentially. Just having a fingerprint to say yes, I want to buy something.
Yeah. So Apple believes in it enough that they're going to put their money where their finger is.
Yeah.
And you can buy things through the store using your fingerprint. And if it truly works, and Apple doesn't lose money on this and get hacked, you're going to find it spreading more and more.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the hacking aspect of it. It's totally hackable. It would be kind of hard to do. But basically, it's the same type of sensor as... It's a capacitive touch sensor, right?
Right.
With like a resolution that's good enough to do fingerprints. And it's on the home button, and it's 360 degrees. You can push it from any direction.
Right.
And it learns as it goes?
It's a little unclear. Okay. They say if they implement it right, it'll be learning as it goes. So you take about 30 seconds to teach your fingerprints to it, and it'll show you how much of it understands until it gets to the point where it's like, yeah, I got it.
Right.
But there's a good potential there that it'll keep learning, and then it'll get better and better.
Yeah. So the idea here is that it's going to just detect the grooves and the valleys. It shows up differently, and you basically get a picture of the thumb, and then they'll compare that, probably markers of the pictures of the thumb, and then encrypt some that into some kind of phrasing, if you will, that would then match another fingerprint that looks exactly the same. Yeah. So the way you'd fake this is it wouldn't work with a picture. It's not a photograph thing. You'd actually have to make a 3D model. Now, there are 3D printers in the home, so it's not really a big deal if you had an image of a person's finger. And cameras are pretty good now, right? You could potentially you could say, hey, wave at me, and take a picture of somebody while they're waving at you, and then get that fingerprint image from that finger, you know, and then print a finger.
Or conceivably lift it off a glass.
Right.
Now, they do have one safeguard in there that this has been a little unclear in the press, but I believe this is true, that they require a living layer on the finger that touches it. So you're going to have to go through an extra step to really fool this thing.
Yeah, this is a heat thing though, right?
It's a heat.
No, they just have a life detecting device.
it will be spoofable, but I think the important part here isn't that somebody could spoof your fingerprint and unlock your phone. Most of the time, the danger is in passing your password from your phone or from your computer up through the internet to some site. And if people actually start using long passwords that are highly random, then people are not going to be able to hack into the various sites.
Oh, what you're saying is the phone will manage the password.
Right.
You'll have to access to the phone and to a fingerprint of the person to be able to get into the sites that they have.
Yeah, while it's conceivable somebody could spoof your phone and get in there, the fact that there's 6 billion people out there in the world and some of them are trying to hack into the websites because people are using passwords like 123456.
Yeah.
That could start to fade away.
So you see that now we'll be able to have password management system built into the phone. Therefore, everybody's passwords will be really strong.
Right.
That's like the goal. Okay, I get that. And then the other thing you could do is you could have a relatively simple password that you have to put with your fingerprint and a simple password, right? If you want to be security conscious, like a PIN, like an ATM PIN, a 4-digit PIN, and then have three fails make it not work. Then you have something you have. The one thing about this biometric thing is in multiple authentication, we've always talked about something you know, like a password, something you have, like maybe one of those little fobs that has a random number, and then something you are. And the idea is it's three factors. The truth is the fingerprint is not something you are. The fingerprint is something you have. And that's the thing that I really want to be clear about. That's why it's spoofable. If we actually had an ability to, and a retina scan, it's not that you are the person, you are a person that has a retina that matches the pattern, but it happens to be that you have that with you. Other people could have that too. So there's just the one caveat I want people to think about. It's possible to spoof it. Therefore, I actually have a password too. I have a feeling if I get one, I will not be using a password. I'll just be using a thumb because of convenience.
Well, I'm going to create a long password that if I actually have to use it, I'm going to really be frustrated.
Yeah, right. Because you'll never use it.
Onomatopoeia.
Now, you're talking about what you have and what you are. There is another article that I just want to bring up quickly. Mm-hmm. A group called Silent Sense is working on a authentication system that just will sense how hard you tap your screen using the motion sensor inside the phone and how you move your phone and how you swipe. And through as few as a couple swipes, it has 98% accuracy. And once you get up to about 10 swipes and taps, it's at 99% accuracy, which still means you're going to have problems where it's not going to recognize you every time. But I think it's fascinating. You're not going to be able to spoof that unless you start getting into robots, I guess.
Or yeah. Unless you drink a lot of coffee before.
I was thinking that too. Or if you're drunk, yeah. Or if you've woken up slowly. You know, my bank did that a while ago. I use BayFed here in Santa Cruz. And my checking account number is no. how much personal information? And they, a while ago, implemented a flash-based login mechanism that theoretically both uses your username, your password, and keeps track of what last machine you logged in, all that. And then theoretically also does biometric or, you know, sensitivity about how fast and such you type. And so for a while, it was triggering. It was fine and fine and fine, and then it would trigger because I typed my password at a different speed, right?
Over 3 in the morning?
Yeah, because you're different during the time of the day. You know, you're different all the time. And slowly that's faded out. Now it's if I log into a new computer, it triggers. So like they turn that off, and I always am in this space of detecting whether a person is a person is more than, you know, you don't always act the same way. So I love the idea. What's the name of this company?
This is called Silent Sense.
Silent Sense. It's a cool idea. I think it's definitely an extra potential.
Well, yeah.
A pattern matching.
And I would say it's probably where fingerprint reading was 10 years ago.
Yep. All right. We're going to do some transportation stuff now. Specifically, Elon Musk has been chatting with Google about the technology and driverless technology, right? Because Google has driverless technology, and Elon Musk chatted with them about possibly putting in all the Teslas. Elon Musk is the organizer of Tesla. And we've talked a bit about Tesla because it's kind of cool. They're expensive. They're way too expensive. He does want to get Tesla's price point down to $30,000. So to be a car that's expensive still, but that's his target. And currently, I think he's about to be profitable on the Tesla business, which is cool because it's been an investment strategy for a while. That's cool. And Elon Musk says about the autopilot, you know, driving car thing, says, I like the word autopilot more than I like the word self-driving. Self-driving sounds like it's going to do something you don't want it to do. Autopilot is a good thing to have in planes, and we should have it in cars, right? So I think that's a better way to think about driving self-driving cars, that especially in the early days, it's an assistive device. It's not the thing that's in control of you. There's a lot of discussion about this and about how Google is going to implement it. I don't even know why Google's, like, Brian, you and I were chatting earlier about self-driving cars and like why Google started. You had a theory on it.
So the first time it ever made sense to me, besides two rich guys that just wanted to tinker with something, was
the founders.
Yeah, exactly. Sergey and Larry Page. The reason why it made sense to me is I realized they have this mapping system for Street View where they drive cars all across the world and they want to constantly keep that up to date. And I know many streets that just haven't been touched yet. So why not build a fleet of auto-driving cars that you don't have to put people in and just keep sending them out there 24 hours a day?
Yeah, I can get that. I mean, I see the mapping cars drive around, you know, San Jose. I think they're always testing the newer stuff. And of course, some of those cars are self-driving. I don't know if all of them are. And I also, like, I was arguing with you in the car right over here as we had a car drive for us. Well, I did. Happened to be piloted by you. But in that, I think that Google does things of this sort not just for one reason, right? So they're definitely doing it because they had a whole bunch of technology. They're storing it in cars. They're mapping. They're taking all these photographs. They have GPS. They're collecting Wi-Fi data access points, which kind of was creepy. And you know, engineers are driving all day kind of doing this, and they're like, gosh, wouldn't it be great if the car could do it themselves? And, you know, oh, yeah, well, the DOG has all this money for that project anyway. And it just seems to be like a simple idea in the sense that we've had this idea for a long time.
Well, the company comes out of a research project, yeah. So they're all about seeing where the research goes.
Yeah. So recently, Google put down $258 million invested into Uber. Either of you know what Uber is?
Nope.
Oh, it's awesome. It's a great way to flag a car when you're in a city. You can see the driver coming up on your phone, and you know exactly who it is, a picture of him. He sees a picture of you before you two ever meet, and you agree
on
a price.
So it's an app.
Yeah, it's an app for your mobile app.
You agree on a price?
Yeah, the price is agreed to before he ever dries up. It is more expensive. I forget how much of a premium you should expect. But it is the way of the future of
right.
getting a...
So
ride.
You're at a bar late at night, you're hanging out with friends, you got your phone with you, you pull out your phone and you put into Uber, I need to go from here to here in about 20 minutes. And then you get some bids back, basically, and you accept one and the driver shows up.
Exactly.
So it's not hailing a cab in the traditional way. Now, when I was actually in New York, last time I was in New York, I took a cab ride, as you do, and the cab driver's like, are you using Haleo? I'm like, no. And she's like, oh, you know, you've got to use Haleo. Not all drivers use it, but it's really great. Okay. And I showed her my Google Glass, and she used Google Glass and was like, this is cool. And then she said, you're using Haleo, we did a tech thing. And Haleo is the same type of thing. You hail a cab, and you have to have the... It's very similar to Uber. But Uber now, because of this $258 million investment from Google, is worth about $3.5 billion. So they're going to do well. And of course, this whole idea is that if you have an app that you get used to using whenever you want to go someplace in a cab, and then you have a sideline project of building drivable cars, self-driving cars, you start really getting the idea that you just tie those together. So it makes sense to invest in the get clientele. And you know, one of the things about cars, especially in a city, is having a car is bad because you have to park it. But a car that doesn't park and just gets picking people up all the time isn't as bad. You need less of them. You don't need parking spots as much, right? You always have ability to move from one point to one point. And that's why, I mean, that's how New York survives with cabs, right? Just a lot of moving vehicles. So it's kind of a cool technology to look at. Brian, do you have any other thoughts on this? Do you think it's a cool... Would you get in a car that drives by itself?
Oh, I'm completely... I can't wait for this. In fact, my whole goal is that these things start coming out before my kids can drive, and I can just put my kids in there and take them somewhere or send the car on its way. I love the concept of the self-driving car just because you get to a point where right now, like... We have cars, and Detroit is our stereotypical, we manufacture cars. But they've always seemed to see themselves as car manufacturers. But what I like about the self-driving cars, you start thinking about this not as a build a car problem, but a transportation problem.
Right.
You start fitting it into a larger system. You start making multiple families being able to buy this. Admittedly, it'll be more expensive, but they can share it among themselves. Or you start having services, maybe from Uber, maybe from Haleo, that you're just using more and more, and you find no need for buying that big SUV just so you can carry around your big dog or your 30 bags of groceries.
I think that's what's exciting about Elon Musk and Tesla looking at this, because he is, that whole company is looking at cars a little differently. And I think that Google's actually having a lot of problems with automobile companies making cars, because one of the things that would be nice is if you designed the car from the get-go with this ability built in. So Google's been talking with different companies that make cars. And Dieter Zetsche, the chief executive of and owner of Mercedes-Benz, says at an event earlier this month, he said, and I'll quote, basically, he said, we like the idea of things that help in traffic and the boring parts of driving, but, quote, we would never automate the cool part of driving. this idea that it might be a nice thing on the sideline, but the cool part. Now, to me, the cool part of driving is driving fast and, you know, curvy roads, and it's the dangerous part. And that's exactly when I don't want a human being in control of the vehicle, right?
Well, on top of that, he's old generation.
Yep.
We keep hearing more and more that today's younger generation, the teenagers, they're not so hip on getting that car. They're not really too worried about it. They want to be talking to their friends, and that's what they're spending their time focusing on.
Right, not buying their first car, but instead just spending time being social and then transport, using Uber and stuff to get around.
So once they become the generation in our shoes, all of a sudden the cool thing about driving is being able to stay on your phone or do your work.
Right. Yeah. And I agree. That's exactly what I like about this, because having been rear-ended twice by somebody texting who was between the ages of 18 and 25.
You don't want them driving.
I cannot wait for these things to be on the road.
The car manufacturers are doing stuff. For example, the 2014 Mercedes S-Class, which will go on sale later this year, is supposed to have a technology where it will slow and speed up based on the car in front of you and will keep itself in the lane. So less rear-ending, assuming that these 18-year-olds can afford an S-Class Mercedes, which I'm assuming is very expensive.
Well, from everything I've been hearing from the car companies and from Tesla, the problem is not a technological problem anymore. The problem is a social problem, getting people interested in this. So I'm all for them coming out with it and letting me give it a try.
Yeah, I like the taxis idea. Just have those running around and all the textures in those. Yes.
We're going to continue with the show in just a second. Lindsay's going to tell us about compact discs, or compact cassettes, excuse me. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to talk a little bit more about Apple and iPhone stuff and camera things, depending on whether you call in with questions and comments about technology. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. This is GeekSpeak on KOSP 889. And GeekSpeak, you can learn everything about GeekSpeak at geekspeak.org, and you can follow us on Twitter and stuff. And I'd love it if people spent the time to promote the show on by voting it on iTunes and all that, especially if you like it. I'm Lyle Troxell, and the air with me is Brian Young and Lindsay Lonnie. Lindsay, what's going on with cassette tapes? Seriously, what?
Yeah, cassette tapes. For those of us who remember them, they turned 50 years old on Friday. Oh. Happy birthday, cassette tapes. Oh, the memories. Philips formally launched the cassette tape on September 13th of 1963.
Wow.
50 years, yeah.
And so, still awesome, I got to say.
Yeah, and you know, I still have one thing full of tapes that are, you know, like band demos and things
absolutely.
Like that.
Yeah.
I don't have a way to play them currently.
You know, most of us don't. And if you do get something that has a way to play them, the first thing it's going to do is destroy the tape.
Right.
You're going to eat it,
exactly.
As they say. Yeah.
I still want to have a sound synthesizer to distort your voice right now and make this story stretch up.
Make that sound when it tears.
That was really good, Brian, actually. That sounded real.
And do you remember the Transformer sound wave? It was one of the Transformers, and in its chest, it had a cassette player.
Yes.
So it was like a little boombox.
Oh, definitely. Oh, what was its name? Oh,
that was Soundwave.
Soundwave.
Yeah.
Okay, you're awesome because you knew that.
Well, the thing is, the new one, they've taken the cassette tape out of its chest and put an MP3 player in. So rest in peace, cassette tape, Soundwave. Welcome to the new generation.
Because the kids wouldn't even know what that is.
Exactly.
All right, Lightning, a couple of the stories you didn't want to miss today. Go.
All right. Google Creative Lab launched Coder to turn Raspberry Pi into a basic web development platform.
Awesome. Raspberry Pi is a less than $30 computer, and you can actually develop websites with it and such. That's cool.
Yeah.
I might have to get some for the kids.
It's like $25, a couple extra for the Wi-Fi, and then you can teach your kids to program web development style.
Of course, you need a monitor and a keyboard, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
A few
but
other
everybody's got those around.
Everyone's
CRTs.
Got those.
There's one in the closet you haven't gotten rid of yet.
Exactly.
And there?
And then the Raspberry Pi, you can also use a different one off of Adafruit, the website, which is an amazing website, and create it as your Wi-Fi access point, and it will block all ads.
Oh,
advertisements
cool.
for all of yours. So even when guests come over, you don't have to install stuff on your computer. You block ads that way.
Okay. So you take the revenue away from websites.
Yeah.
Hey.
Except you can add rules to allow certain websites that you want to support.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So you just ignore the ones you don't want.
All right. One more.
All right. Well, this one's kind of a long one, so let me skip down and see what else I've got. Oh, seen this app. It helps music fans wrangle their favorite artists' multiple social media feeds. So it's an app, and basically it goes through all social media, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, SoundCloud, things like that, and it sees what's having the most activity and then shows you a feed of all your favorite artists' top activity.
Oh.
So I love music, and I have all this stuff on my Facebook, and I can't see the stuff I want to see because I'm seeing all this random, you know, day-to-day, oh, I had this for lunch. And
hey.
I don't really.
Just defriend me then. No, go on.
Yeah. So I'll put up a link to
that. Okay, that sounds cool.
Yeah.
So when you want to look at the music stuff, you can pay attention to just the music feed.
Yeah. And it's only the top things that are going on those particular music feeds. So it goes by how active their posts are and puts those things to the top. So,
all right. Let's see. We've done some. Well, since you mentioned that one, Twitter actually has a music Twitter side too. It actually uses your Twitter account, and you can actually look at just music-related stuff through Twitter, which is kind of interesting. Twitter recently declared that they're going public. There was rumors of it, that they were filing and such, but it turns out that they, of course, tweeted that they're doing this. And the tweet just read, "We've confidentially submitted an S-1 to the SEC for a planned IPO. This tweet does not constitute an offer of any securities for sale." Because they have to do that little denote.
Right.
And that was September 12th, 2 p.m. Hmm. Now, one other thing is Twitter also just purchased this major company, MoPub, for nobody knows how much. But MoPub is a company that deals with mobile publication advertising. So if you make a mobile app and you want to advertise, they have a resource and tools and all that to do that. And there was a rumor about this, right?
Yeah. So you know how your phone can send you push notifications, and you could set it up so that all your tweets or some of your tweets are pushed to your phone. So as you're walking around, you get a little beep, you look down and you go, oh, Twitter just had, or Lyle just had breakfast at somewhere. So there is apparently some evidence that they are playing around with pushing ads to to your phone through the same mechanism. Twitter, of course, going IPO and has been working on their business plan for quite a while now to figure out the best way to make money. But if this happens, I know that there's a lot of people that will just start turning it off.
Yep. Okay, we're going to start taking calls, but first I want to do a little flash thing of the iPhone 5S camera. Brian and I did a whole bunch of research on it and like looked at it. It's really kind of a cool camera. There's an interesting article that we'll be linked to from geekspeak.org if you want to learn more about that. You got a little Android Apple thing you want to mention quickly before we take calls?
Oh, yeah. So you really like your glass, don't you?
I love Google Glass.
So there's this really interesting article of, from somebody who was going off. His name's Robert Scoble. He was going off about how much better the iPhone is. He was listing everything, that the quality of the phones, the fact that they're giving away iWork now for free for the new phones, and how it is Apple's one of the few companies that really seems to be trying to secure your data in a helpful way, and theft prevention and deterrence. But in the end, he sums it all up by saying, I'm still going with Android, and it's all about Google Glass.
Yeah, me too. I switched to Android a while ago because of Google Glass, and just this week, I started picking up my iPhone because it was on the counter and I could do email through it quickly, and it just felt so much better. Now, I don't know if it felt, and it's just a 4. It's not even a 4S or anything. It felt so much better, maybe because I've used it for so long, or maybe because it's just it's better. I don't know. And so I'm kind of in the space of, I wish that they would just have an app that did Google Glass through the iPhone, and I would probably go back. All right, we're taking calls here on GeekSpeak. We've actually had some people waiting, and I'm so sorry. Hal from Santa Cruz, hi.
Hi, good morning. I had an experience yesterday which kind of accelerated the change in the way I see the Internet and our connectivity. I had a visit from the Google Loon people who wanted to videotape me putting together and installing one of their antennas.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with the Google Loon project?
Google Loon project is putting floating Wi-Fi access points in almost in orbit, really high, that float around the planet and basically give everybody Wi-Fi.
Yeah, it's not orbit. They'd be in the stratosphere,
sure.
And so they'd be moving around by the wind. And they've done a pilot project in New Zealand where they put 30 balloons up just to cover Wellington and what's the other big city in
parts of New Zealand, sure.
Auckland, Christchurch.
So apparently, and I'm inferring this from what they have on the web about the project, that they're going to, the whole Earth is going to be surrounded by these balloons, which will only stay up there, if I remember correctly, about 10 days each, and they'll be constantly launching them.
I don't think 10 days each is correct. They stay up a lot longer than that. But go on.
It's not a lot longer than that. It might be twice that. Mm-hmm. But it's an amazingly short amount
of
time.
Why were they talking to you about antennas? Are you an antenna guy?
Because they're testing out what they want to do is they want to send you a box with an antenna in it that you assemble and mount on your own roof,
uh-huh,
so that they eliminate the installation cost for you to be connected to the Loon Internet system.
Awesome. So, I love it.
So I saw this as another way in which they're going to be able to track everything I do, even if I'm not using a cell phone, even if I'm at home on my Internet.
Right.
And last week, I bought a Windows 8 computer just to see what they're like, and I found that Microsoft wants me to be connected to Microsoft all the time.
Oh, yeah.
So I see this competition between Microsoft and Google, and maybe the Twitter folks want to enter that race.
Everybody's into that race, yeah.
So you're their captive, and they know everything about you all the time that they're selling.
But Hal, don't worry. Google's not evil. They even say it.
I'm sorry?
Google's not evil. They even say that. So that's the thing I know. I have, you know, Google Glass on my face, right? So it's this little device that is kind of controlled by Google all the time. And it's definitely this question of privacy and like how creepy are these corporations. And I don't know what's going to happen. And it's kind of an engaging, interesting space. But yeah, Project Loon's a cool idea. Making ubiquitous internet across the planet. At some point, we will have that. The human race will have internet covering the entire planet. That's just going to happen, whether this will be the technology or not. But thanks for the call. Really appreciate it, Hal. Thanks for listening. And you participate all the time by giving me great stories and stuff, so I really appreciate that too.
Well, I think you guys should look into it beyond just whether it's cool technology and whether it's important to connect everybody on the planet. I agree with both of those comments. But what about the fact that we've totally given up our privacy and security. You guys started the show with that, and I yep. called in earlier because of that. And these are questions that aren't really being asked by the people that are dealing with the technology.
They are being asked. We talk about it all the time. Actually, in fact, tech shows are a lot about privacy and security. That's why we talk about these topics all the time. And one of the concerns, of course, is that the place that this should exist is at the legislative area. And it is a very technical, complicated topic, right? But the legislators have to be aware. And I, you know, from my own highly optimistic perspective, I think that what we're going to see is a lot of falling down and failure around security and privacy. And we've already seen that. We're going to see it more and more. We're going to see really bad laws. But the population that's growing up right now in 20 years will understand this stuff so much better. And we will get good legislation eventually. We will get privacy. So for a while, you know, Google might go totally crazy, power-hungry, evil corporation at some point. It already is potentially, but we're going to fix this as a society. That's my take on it. So that's why I can say it's cool. We'll have ubiquitous internet and it's cool technology. And yeah, it's going to be really creepy.
So it's a race between the next generation.
If you haven't listened to Terry Gross's interview with the Washington Post reporter who released the Snowden stuff.
Yes.
You really need to listen to it.
I know.
Here's a guy who's been covering national security forever. And he says, as careful as he is, he doesn't assume that he's protected against.
That's right. And we've covered that on this show, and I agree. Right now, there is not private communication. You can't be assured of it. There's a lot of happening. And the headlines that come out are wrong, and and it's an interesting space. I find it to be a fascinating time, and I love being in that space where I can understand the technology enough and help people understand it more. So, Hal, thanks. I will listen. I have heard part of Terry Gross's story in that regard, and I'll listen to it again, the whole thing. Thank you so much, Hal, for the call.
Take a look at the Loon website.
Yeah. No, I've researched the Loon website. I agree. It's a pretty interesting project. Project Loon is done by Google. It's putting balloons into the stratosphere that have internet in it. It's kind of a cool idea. All right. We also have Rich from SoCal. Rich, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. I found myself a little confused about your description of the iPhone learning your fingerprint, because the description you gave is all positive examples, like it's your finger. And I was wondering, maybe I'm answering my own question, do they go online? Is there like a database of 10 million fingerprints that aren't yours that they're making sure
no.
they don't hit?
I'm really glad you called in, because you're right. That wasn't clear. So it's really important to understand just a couple concepts. What they're doing is they're looking for markers on your fingerprint. And then they take that information and they put it through something called a hashing function. Now, we've talked about encryption a lot, but what hashing is, it's a one-way process. You take something in, you put it in the blender, and you get something out. And that something out is always going to be the same thing based on what you put in. So it's a way of scrambling it that is one way. You cannot take the result of that hash and figure out what the original data was.
Right.
All you can do is compare the hash that your fingerprint created to what is in the phone's database. And I don't believe that phone database even gets uploaded to Apple.
It does if you back up your system.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where do the negative examples that it...
Let's talk about it. Let me describe what Brian just described one more time. So when I put a password into a website, I normally send that password through on the internet to the website. The website takes it and goes through a hash and then compares. This is a mathematical translation, and does a comparative on what they've stored with that. And if it matches, they know that the same numbers are the same. But they don't actually know what the password is. And this is the right way to do password stuff. You have a secret. You translate that secret into something that can only go one direction, that gives you an ID, and then that ID is the thing you match against. So the phone's doing the same thing. It takes a picture of your fingerprint. It looks at the curve characteristics, a whole bunch of mathematical characteristics that it will be repetitively be able to look at. They get a number from that, which is basically something that you wouldn't want to share with anybody. It's a pattern of your finger. Then they translate that with a hash, which is a one-directional thing that comes up with a random-looking string. That thing can be recreated only if you have your original fingerprint idea. Apple doesn't save your image, their first original image. It only saves that comparative thing. Anytime it wants to see if it's you, you take the image, you translate it through mathematically, you get the comparative, and you see it's the same. So even if that comparative number gets saved to Apple, all they know is the person that has that fingerprint can create that number. They don't know what the actual fingerprint is. That's the pattern, the idea at least. And that's why it's kind of got a good side, not a lot of bad side. And the reason that's why we jumped into how would you fool it? All you have to do to fool it is get a copy of the fingerprint and make a 3D map that's kind of warm of that fingerprint, and you'd be able to also engage in that process.
But when you're training it, if you have five different people come in and put their fingers down and claim it's the same person, what happens?
That won't work. It'll fail. But you can add multiple fingerprints that have authentication to it.
So each fingerprint gets tested multiple times until the phone says, yeah, I got it.
Yep.
And then you can do that for five different fingers,
right,
whether they're on your hand or your
And it's a good idea to do it more than one finger of your body because, you know, what if you get like a splinter or something in your finger and your fingerprint is problematic or something? You want to get at least a couple of your fingers to make it work. So there you go.
Okay.
Thank you, Rich, for the call.
Fine. Right,
bye-bye. Yeah, the idea of uploading fingerprints to a database.
But at the same time, when you go get your driver's license here in California, you've already given your fingerprint.
Yeah, that is very true. This is GeekSpeak. We're closing the show out. You can learn more about GeekSpeak at geekspeak.org. This has been GeekSpeak for September 14th, 2013. GeekSpeak's a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. In the air with me was Lindsay Lonnie. Thank you for being here, Lindsay.
Thanks.
And Brian Young.
It was a real pleasure.
Brian's looking for work. I'm Lyle Troxell. Find out more about this episode or any episode of GeekSpeak at geekspeak.org. GeekSpeak is a Creative Commons Attribution 3 licensed, which means you can reuse it if you'd like, as long as you tell people the content came from us. Stay tuned for Car Talk.